You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Before this very day is over, someone will be murdered, children will be bitten by rats, Negroes will be denied jobs because of their race, 50,000 drug addicts will need another fix, 50 jobs will leave the city, countless families will be without water, without heat, and all of us will breathe the deadly air that is the same as smoking two packs of cigarettes.
John Lindsay took office as mayor of New York in 1966 with an ambitious liberal agenda that included reaching out to the poor and minorities. What followed over the next 8 years was unprecedented social, racial, and economic upheaval. And when he left City Hall in 1973, Lindsay was blamed for a skyrocketing crime rate and the city's growing debt. But how much was he simply a victim of the times? Now his complex legacy is being given a fresh look on several fronts. There's an exhibit called America's Mayor, John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York, that opens today at the Museum of the City of New York. And New York Times Urban Affairs correspondent Sam Roberts edited a companion book of the same name. There's also a new documentary called Fun City Revisited, The Lindsay Years, that airs tomorrow night at 8 on Channel 13. The film's Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, Tom Casciato, and Sam Roberts join me now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Many people consider Lindsay to be a failure, but the 8 years he was in office were some of the most turbulent in American history. We had the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, in New York, the Ocean Hill-Brownsville controversy, increasing drug use. There were three shocking assassinations. How much was he simply a victim of the times?
Well, the times were pretty turbulent, as you say. One of the things that we forget is that you measure a mayor against what he promises, the challenges he faced, the resources he was able to muster, and whether he left a better city to his successor. There have certainly been better and worse mayors than John Lindsay, but there are few who had to govern in more turbulent times than he did.
Was he an unlikely mayor of New York? He's a Republican, and he comes across as very patrician, Tom.
Well, I think he was a likely mayor of New York. You take one look at the guy, and he's the likely mayor of something. He's the likely leader of something because he was stunning. As a filmmaker, you rarely come upon a subject like that where you just take one look at the guy and you just say, this is a person who was made for public life.
It was like central casting sent him in, like Robert Redford playing a politician.
Everybody who I talk to about Mayor Lindsay who remembers him, black, white, tall, short, straight, gay, whatever it is, the first thing they say was he was so good looking.
He defined charisma, in fact. I mean, this was, remember, right after the Kennedys. John Kennedy certainly did that on a national scale, particularly after Dwight Eisenhower. And after Bob Wagner as mayor, whatever you think of him, this was a literally towering charismatic figure.
But how did a Republican get elected in a city where Democrats almost always won?
He got elected the same way he got reelected, by being lucky enough to have two more conservative opponents both times.
Well, he did have some of the oddest opponents, or people at least running in those elections, in both the elections, William F. Buckley. Then he had Norman Mailer and Jimmy Breslin running as a team. They were odd times.
Those were incredible times with very big figures, larger than life.
Could we compare him to some degree to LaGuardia, the appeal? Because LaGuardia was also a Republican, but kind of ran above party. And so did Giuliani and Bloomberg, at least initially.
Well, every mayor's measured against LaGuardia, and properly so. I think he probably was the greatest mayor, certainly the 20th century, in terms of those three criteria we talked about earlier. But as Arthur Mann, a historian, wrote in the Sunday Times magazine just before Lindsay was being inaugurated, you could make an argument that the relief roles that LaGuardia dealt with were not the same as the welfare roles that Lindsay did, that slot machines were not the same as drug addiction, and that Lindsay was the first mayor, certainly in New York, who had to incorporate black New Yorkers into the American dream.
So he became a mayor in difficult times, and he was promising a lot, wasn't he? We just heard that speech, which, by the way, he delivered quite well.
I think it was a whole new kind of governance he was promising, and indeed he delivered it very well. And he was promising it at a time when he may not have been able to really fund everything that he wanted to do. But these were the kind of promises that were being made in the 60s at this time. It's hard for us now, I think, in our time, to look back and see that kind of idealism unjaded, because we, most of us, just aren't that way today.
That's right. It was an era of new frontier, of great society, and you can certainly make an argument in retrospect that he overpromised and therefore is measured against a lot of that rather than what he actually delivered.
And he ran into a major problem on the very first day. There was a transit strike that lasted for 12 days.
Yes, and part of that, you can argue, too, was of his own making. He said, he was going to defy the power brokers. One of those power brokers, certainly Mike Quill of the Transport Workers Union. Bob Wagner left town and left him the strike, but by, most analysts would say that Lindsay probably could have settled it quickly and probably for a lot less than he ultimately did.
But the sense was that Wagner used to cave in, pay off the unions, and then somebody else was going to have to pay for it. Did Lindsay see himself as being the man who's going to hold the line?
Absolutely. Lindsay was not going to do that. And I think that the iconic Lindsay that people came to know was invented, perhaps a little bit accidentally, by the transit strike. Because what Lindsay did when all the transit wouldn't work was he walked. And he walked through the city. And he walked being photographed through the city so that he was in the papers walking. And he came to be known as the mayor who was on his feet, who was out on the street. Whenever there was trouble, he was with New Yorkers.
On the other hand, a lot of people associated him with the problems in the transit system. I remember being stuck in a stalled train some years after. The man, we're stuck there in between two stations. The man next to me yells out, "That lousy Lindsay," as though Lindsay was personally responsible for anything that went wrong on the subway.
And it could have been years after he was mayor, in fact. But he became sort of an iconic target, if you will. Interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right about labor. He wanted not to cave into the unions, but he also refused to participate in the dance, the kabuki of union negotiations, and he wasn't going to have any part in that. And that is how government works, and that's how Bob Wagner ran the government.
Well, in 68, we're talking about years later, there was a 9-day sanitation worker strike with garbage piling up on the streets.
And you can make
was
an
he
argument,
holding the same line
You
there?
Can make an argument that he won that one because he did stand up, and ultimately the support for the sanitation workers crumbled, and they had to settle for less than they might have gotten otherwise.
What about the other unions? Because there are so many city unions that a mayor has to deal with.
Well, I was going to say about the garbage strike first. You could say that he won that one, but New Yorkers still experienced all that stink, all that garbage, all those rats. Some of it was set afire. So even though you could say he won the strike, many New Yorkers did blame him. It was Lindsay again. It was Lindsay's New York. Look, it happens on your watch.
And, of course, what happened after that was after he won the second term, he became much more accommodating to the unions, wanted their political support, just as Wagner had, particularly in his third term, and gave them generous settlements that in no way corresponded to their public denunciations of him. In fact, Victor Gottbaum and others, there was sort of an inverse relationship between the level at which they denounced the mayor and the contract settlements they received.
My guests are Sam Roberts, who has written a companion book to a show that opens today at the Museum of the City of New York called America's Mayor, John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York. Also with us is Tom Casciato, who is the filmmaker responsible for Fun City Revisited, the Lindsay Years. It airs tomorrow night at 8 on Channel 13. Let's talk about those two titles. America's Mayor, I always think of that as being applied to Rudy Giuliani, whether that's fair or not. So were people saying that about Lindsay before?
Well, I think that Lindsay deserves that title and certainly had it in many respects before Rudy Giuliani, for better or worse, usurped it. He created an urban agenda. He brought the plight of the cities in this country to a national attention. He served as co-chairman of the Kerner Commission on Civil Disorders. He galvanized fellow mayors in New York State and across the country to try and lobby for the city. So I think in that sense, he was America's mayor. You look in the book at the photographs of him, the drawings of him on the covers of Time and Newsweek and Life magazines, there are not too many mayors who were in that category.
Well, he was also talking about national issues like the Vietnam War, but that's because he'd served in Congress.
Well,
didn't he have a different kind of sensibility than most mayors?
Well, I think he realized that a lot more problems had to be solved in Washington. And, you know, this might be characterized as passing the buck, but I think, you know, one would argue, and Mayor Bloomberg in Washington today, in fact, making the same argument that some things need to be dealt with on the national level.
Tom, what about Fun City? Wasn't that used ironically?
Not originally. Lindsay, during the transit strike, remarked rather offhandedly that he thought New York was still a fun city. And I think then it was used to bludgeon him because so many New Yorkers were not having fun at that point. But the name stuck, and I think it's a very appropriate name to think about that time. And as you'll see when you see our film, Lindsay very much looked like he knew how to have fun. You're always seeing him with different celebrities and out introducing Bob Hope at Madison Square Garden and having a good time.
But he also made the city fun. You could make an argument with happenings, with street closings, made it more pedestrian-friendly. I mean, they made parks more accessible, built Westpocket parks. There were things that made this city a more of a destination.
Absolutely.
But it was also a time of white flight, and the city's racial makeup changed. Let's listen to something that he said about racial discrimination.
There is a virus, and the chief virus here is deterioration and decay, oppression sometimes, closed doors, discrimination.
New York was spared the rioting that broke out in dozens of other cities after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Does he deserve any credit for that?
I think he deserves almost all the credit for that. We did have rioting. It was sort of overlooked because, by comparison, it was relatively small. He walked the streets that night of Martin Luther King's assassination, and the reason his empathy resonated with people was that it was not the first time he had walked the streets. He had been there before, and people really knew he cared. The problem, as you mentioned initially, was that did he care about the white ethnic people in New York? And the job of any mayor, particularly a mayor who authored a report that said America was dividing into two societies, one white, one black, was to bridge that gap. And many people, so-called white ethnic people, think he did not.
That was the Kerner Commission that he was appointed to by President Johnson?
Yes, and he was co-chairman.
So New Yorkers felt that he favored blacks and poor people?
Well, there was one incident in 1969 where that really came to light, when a huge snowstorm happened that some of your listeners, maybe you yourself, are going to remember.
I remember it. And people in Queens were very unhappy.
People
especially
in Queens did not get their snow plowed, and they were angry, and that was mostly white working class people, and they did believe that Lindsay was looking out for someone else who wasn't them. Now, I personally don't believe that just because you think you deserve city services, you're some kind of a racist, or that you think that someone is helping someone else and not you.
But isn't that an out-of-borough problem as much as it was a racial thing? Manhattan always seemed to get plowed first.
Everybody says it was pretty easy driving through Manhattan during that snowstorm.
That's true. I mean, it became a class thing as well as a race thing, but they are so intertwined. And there was no question, and Lindsay, I remember in an interview with me years later, acknowledged that he should have been a lot more sensitive to the needs of the white middle class.
What about the Stonewall riots breaking out while he was in office? Did he take a position on gay rights? I know you don't deal with this in the show, but it occurred to me since we were talking about all the other...
There's a photograph in the book about that, and I'm frankly not entirely sure. I think he was definitely sympathetic. I'm not sure what the administration did as a matter of policy, though.
There's a remarkable little piece of business at the Museum of the City of New York exhibit where you see a letter written, I believe it's at the very end of 65 or maybe early 66 when he's first elected, and it's from a group saying, we represent the homosexual citizens of New York. And it really was before the term gay was in use. And it was at a time when I imagine it was pretty dangerous for people to label themselves the homosexual citizens of New York. But they clearly looked to Lindsay as someone who could potentially be their champion.
We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York, which opens today, called America's Mayor John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York. It's also the title of a book that was edited by New York Times Urban Affairs correspondent Sam Roberts. And there's a film being shown tomorrow at 8 on Channel 13 called Fun City Revisited, The Lindsay Years, and filmmaker Tom Casciato is also with us. Stay with us for more talk about this. We're back with our discussion of The Lindsay Years with Tom Casciato, the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker whose Fun City Revisited, The Lindsay Years, will be airing tomorrow night at 8 on Channel 13, and Sam Roberts of The New York Times, who has written a companion book to a show that opens today at the Museum of the City of New York called America's Mayor, John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York. It was a time of a lot of racial tension, and that led to a teacher strike, didn't it?
Race defined almost everything that went on in New York in that period. It led to the teacher strike. It led to the Forest Hills housing dispute. It sort of was the underlying factor in so many controversies that went on.
But don't New Yorkers see themselves as being more enlightened about these things than people in the rest of the country?
More enlightened, but they also think of themselves in terms of fairness. And they thought that black and then the growing number of Hispanic New Yorkers were getting an unfair edge.
And then the strike, which all grew out of Ocean Hill, Brownsville, raised tensions between blacks and Jews.
It did, and I think it's important to note that unlike the sanitation strike and the garbage strike, the teacher strike did not involve a direct negotiation between the teachers' union and the mayor, because the mayor did not negotiate with the teachers' union. And Lindsay took, I think, a lot of the blame for what happened at Ocean Hill, Brownsville. But it was not as if he could have come in and with a plan offered by the city to the teachers. So he was a little bit on the – even though he was in the middle of that and he was probably very flummoxed by it, maybe he was so flummoxed because he was on the periphery of it.
Although, you know, David Dinkins got criticism for not exercising leadership in the boycott of Korean grocery stores, you can make an argument that Lindsay needed to exercise more leadership, even though he had no direct authority in the Ocean Hill-Brownsville dispute, too.
There's the bully pulpit job of the mayor.
And I think he was flummoxed. He didn't really know what to do.
What about welfare? There were growing welfare roles in the city. Did he try to change policies?
Enormously growing welfare roles, and that was considered an entitlement. It was interesting, as I cited that quote earlier from Arthur Mann, the historian, talking about relief roles during the Depression. Well, relief was intended to be a very temporary phenomenon. Welfare became a question of dependency, a question of entitlement, and there were people, liberals in the city, who were lobbying to flood the welfare rolls, in part to break the system. And the whole notion of things like workfare were regarded as something out of the Middle Ages.
Well, did this all contribute to the city's financial woes?
I think it clearly did. That and generous union settlements and short-term borrowing, which eventually caught up with the city. And it's important to remember, I wrote a chapter in the book about what it was that Lindsay inherited from the Wagner administration. And frankly, until I wrote that, I had not known or forgotten that a lot of these fiscal gimmicks actually began in the last term of the Wagner administration.
The city was facing a rising debt when he left office. There was a threat of bankruptcy. Was it just simply because of all of those things that he inherited from Wagner, and then the things that he was forced to do because he had to learn to be more pragmatic?
Well, I'm not sure if you can blame Lindsay for the fiscal crisis, the brush with bankruptcy that occurred in 1975, but he certainly contributed to it, and he certainly exacerbated a situation that was rapidly going downhill. The gap between income and expenditures in the city wasn't created by Lindsay, but it sure widened under his administration.
It is ironic, isn't it, that the man who we elected to clean up the mess, Abe Beame, had been Lindsay's opponent in the first election for mayor.
He and William F. Buckley in 1965, that's right.
Ironic, and also ironic that he was the controller, that he was the one who always was saying, let's rein things in, and Abe Beame, poor Abe Beame, managed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
What was Lindsay's relationship with the police department like?
Tense. One of the very first things he did as a candidate was to call for a civilian complaint review board, the idea to make the police department at least appear to be more fair to minorities, and that created a tense relationship. And in fact, within his first year as mayor, the PBA organized a referendum and had that overturned.
Now, drug use was a major cause of crime, and that was a problem all across the country. Well, was it worse in New York?
It was worse in New York, I think, by the sheer numbers. Lindsay desperately tried to find a solution for it, introduced methadone maintenance as one possibility. There was even a proposal to, on a very experimental basis, distribute heroin to addicts. And the political ramifications of that were so great that that was very quickly and quietly abandoned.
How much was his problem a fight between idealism and pragmatism? Because he did bring in an awful lot of people into city government who had never worked in those kinds of jobs before with a hope of reshaping the city in other ways as well, urban design, urban planning, changing the city's attitudes about the arts.
There are people who pop up at certain times in history who have the kind of charisma that they drag the young along with them, and they elevate the ideals of young people. And Lindsay was absolutely that person. And I think you could make a pretty fair argument that that idealism ran up into some pretty intransigent pragmatic problems, and that maybe that was part of the difficulty of the Lindsay administration. But it was also part of the inspiration of the Lindsay administration.
But it also led to all sorts of other kinds of consequences. After the fatal shooting of anti-war protesters at Kent State University in 1970, he ordered the flags at City Hall to be flown at half staff. And that caused a major uproar.
He took sides.
You know, it was the hard hat riot, literally a riot. And Matt Troy, the city councilman from Queens, ran up to the roof of City Hall, I remember, and raised the flag back to full staff. Sid Davidoff, the mayor's aide, lowered it again. And he did take sides, not cynically at all, but it was, in fact, the war in Vietnam, his opposition to it, that helped reelect him.
He criticized the police for standing by when the construction workers attacked student protesters.
That is true. And my recollection is they did do that.
Anyone who thinks we invented divisiveness in our own era ought to just take a look back at the Lindsay years.
So here he is. He has his rough first term, and then he's reelected. You would have thought he didn't have a chance in hell.
Well, he had a chance for, again, that same reason as the first time. He had two much more conservative opponents in John Markey and Mario Procaccino. He had the Mets, a World Series victory, an even more improbable victory than Lindsay's reelection. He had Golda Meir visiting New York and embracing John Lindsay. He had a lot going for him. It was sort of this perfect storm of political opportunities, and Lindsay took advantage of them. Remember that neither time did he get elected with the majority of the vote.
He also had the gumption, when he lost his own party's primary as the sitting mayor, to run as a third-party candidate. And he won.
And you can make the argument that that helped elect him, that he might have had a tougher time if he had won as a Republican. He also did one other thing, which you credit David Garth and Dick Aurelio. He admitted he made mistakes. People wanted him to eat crow, and he did. Now, if you go back to that commercial, you'll find he really didn't admit to that much. But he at least created the impression that he was saying, I'm not perfect. This is the second toughest job.
Well, actually, I'm going to play a soundbite of him apologizing for the dealing. This is a campaign ad that you're talking about.
Yep.
But first, let me remind my listeners that my guests are Sam Roberts of the New York Times. He's the urban affairs correspondent there. And he is the author of a book called America's Mayor, John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York, which is the companion book to a show that opens today at the Museum of the City of New York. Also with us is Tom Cusciato, the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker whose film Fun City Revisited, The Lindsay Years, airs tomorrow night at 8 on Channel 13. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's listen to a little bit from that 1969 campaign ad.
I guessed wrong on the weather before the city's biggest snowfall last winter, and that was a mistake. But I put 6,000 more cops on the streets, and that was no mistake. The school strike went on too long, and we all made some mistakes. But I brought 225,000 new jobs to this town, and that was no mistake.
That sounds like a politician talking honestly.
Well, honestly, but parse the words. He said he was wrong about the weather. Well,
but.
You know, big deal. And he, you know, a lot of other people, including him, made mistakes about the school strike. The fascinating thing about that commercial is that it took about 33 takes on the back porch of Gracie Mansion to try and get it right. I would love to see the outtakes of that commercial.
Look, that may be a classic non-apology apology, but compared to the politicians and the way they talk in our own time and the way they are managed by their handlers and the corporate message that they always stay on unerringly at all times, I think that was a remarkable admission.
It was a remarkable admission and a remarkable piece of political theater.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting that despite all of that, you say he did have a very different second term. So he just learned to play the game?
In part, yes. He accommodated the unions. He got more done. You can make an argument in terms of management practices. He was less confrontational to a great extent. He then, one could argue, squandered a lot of that in running for president in 1972, however briefly.
Well, he switched from the Republican Party to the Democrats and tried to then become the Democratic nominee for president, as you say. Well, that was really pushing it.
Not a great track record for mayors running for president.
That's for sure. And there's a reason that no mayor of New York City has been elected to a higher office since at least the 19th century. But I remember I was at Gracie Mansion for the announcement of that party switch, and the level of anticipation, the level of expectation was just absolutely enormous. Enormous.
Now, I assumed that people, listeners, knew about the Ocean Hill-Brownsville controversy, but a lot of people have called in to say, could you please explain what happened there?
Well, frankly, I had never heard of Ocean Hill before then. I grew up in Brownsville. But it was a decision. The Ford Foundation came in and created a number of local school boards. This was an effort to make the school system more decentralized, let parents, let the community have more of a say in how their children were being educated. The assumption was this system was broken. Here might be one way to fix it. And unfortunately, the place that it was tried was a mostly black area with mostly black students and mostly white teachers and principals. And the local school board, which was controlled and run by black people, decided to transfer or fire, depending on your definition, some of the white teachers, violating their seniority rights, and it became a racial issue, a union seniority issue. Now, you can make an argument, again, in retrospect, if they had created two districts, one in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and one in Forest Hills, you might have been able to somehow accommodate everyone's concerns. But this just was doomed from the beginning.
And it also caused tension between the Jewish community and the black community.
Well, most of the teachers who were white also happened to be Jewish, and it fostered anti-Semitism in a very public way, and there were bitter racial and anti-Semitic feelings voiced on both sides.
Now, I mentioned earlier urban planning and the parks. He tried to open up the parks?
He did. I think he made the parks it became, as Sam was saying earlier, he did help make it a fun city in a non-ironic way by making the parks places that people wanted to go to.
So I'm assuming that the mayors who followed all looked at the failures and successes and proceeded accordingly.
Well, they didn't have much choice. They were left with no money in the till. So they had to cut back. Beam, in effect, was superseded by a control board appointed mostly by the governor. And then Koch came in and had to balance the budget and didn't have the same latitude, even if he had wanted to create the kind of programs that Lindsay did until years later.
So what would you say were Lindsay's biggest successes? Are we still feeling the positive aspects of his legacy?
Well, I think the two legacies that are the most enduring are, one, he kept New York from burning. That may seem quaint today, but it was certainly something that was feared at the time. There would have been no city for Giuliani or Bloomberg or Koch to fix if it had burned down. And the second thing, as Tom mentioned earlier, is the level of the people he attracted to city government, many of whom stayed in public service or even constructive private service for decades to come.
Those people, I think, are still carrying the same torches now that they carried in the 60s and the early 70s. And that sort of idealism, I think, seeps out from them to younger people, and it's still part of what makes the city the city.
Why are we do we have this exhibit, book, and film today?
I can only speak about the film. For me, it's the perfect time for a John Lindsay film because he has receded enough into history that when you look at those extraordinary black and white commercials of him, you get an incredible sense of a time that is gone. Meanwhile, his younger followers are still totally vigorous, have great anecdotes to tell, and they can bring in through interviews the period alive for us. So I couldn't ask for a better time for a John
Lindsay documentary. And the museum did retrospectives on Pat Moynihan, did one on Ed Koch, and this is sort of a natural progression, and one on Lindsay certainly overdue.
In the film, one of the things that struck me was Mike Quill and his style, something that you just can't imagine happening today.
No, I think not. You know, you don't. He spoke with a very thick brogue. You don't even hear that many New Yorkers speaking that way today. So I think the film really does evoke a time that is somewhat lost to us.
The film is called Fun City Revisited, The Lindsay Years. It will be broadcast tomorrow night at 8 on Channel 13. And it was made in part by the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Tom Casciato, who's been our guest here, and Sam Roberts of the New York Times, the urban affairs correspondent for the Times, has written the companion book to an exhibit that opens today at the Museum of the City of New York called America's Mayor, John V. Lindsay and the Reinvention of New York. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Leonard, thank you.
Thank you.